A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We've talked a bit in the past about weird, capital W-E-I-R-E-D parenting and also non-weird parenting, and maybe give a little explanation for listeners about what that means. And I'm always trying to, with parenting, question the kind of Western, Anglo-oriented parenting ideals and values that we take for granted, that they must be scientific or researched or made up and not based on anything. And the way that the rest of the world parents, non-weird parenting, has thousands of years of history and development and is not less valid because it's not Western. Anyways, my question about non-weird parents today is about daycare. So obviously and we were really lucky that we were able to keep our baby home with us for over a year since we were working from home, and he just happened to be a pretty chill guy who we were able to balance that with, at least for a long time. But finally we said, okay, we have to get some work done. And we happened to find a really lovely daycare just a few minutes from us, really sweet, really warm, that we're happy with, and he seems happy with. And the first few days, in his typical fashion, he didn't mind being left there at all. He was just so happy to have all kinds of toys to play with. Didn't even notice we left. The second week is another story. He also hasn't felt so good. He's been a bit under the weather, so I think that's part of it. But he's been crying when I leave him there, and it's been really rough for me. And I know that that's a common thing for parents, being really rough when. So my question today is about, in non-weird parenting societies where daycare maybe is less of a thing, or parenting duties are shared in a different way, maybe the baby stay with you while you're gathering. If you're, you know, in a hunter-gatherer society, maybe the babies are just with you and get passed around to the different parents, or maybe you live somewhere where grandparents are able to take care of your kids. But is this phenomenon, which I can tell from Facebook groups, is across the board, all parents, moms especially, are all struggling this week with leaving their babies crying at daycare where we live. So are in any of those kind of more traditional parenting societies, do they use daycare? And if so, do they have this problem too?
Hannah sent us this one, and it arrives at the exact moment every parent in our neighborhood is apparently living it. She describes the classic arc. First week at daycare, the baby barely glances up from the toy basket. Second week, he cries when she leaves, and she's standing in the parking lot feeling like she's done something wrong. Her question is whether that gut punch moment is a human universal or something specific to how the West organizes family life. She wants to know if non-weird societies even have daycare, and if they do, whether parents there feel this same specific misery.
And the frame she's using matters, because weird isn't an insult. It's a technical term from a paper that landed in 2010 in Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Heinrich, Heine, and Norenzayan coined it: Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic. Their claim was that psychology had been mistaking a narrow slice of humanity for the whole species. 96% of psychology research participants came from weird societies, which represent about 12% of the global population.
So the discipline that tells us what normal child development looks like built its model of normal on roughly 1 in 8 humans.
And not just any 1 in 8, the weirdest 1 in 8, if you'll allow the pun. Undergraduate students, mostly. People who answer flyers on campus. The most studied human in the history of psychology is the American college sophomore. We know more about how they form attachments, respond to incentives, and process emotion than we know about everyone else combined.
Which means when a Western parent reads that babies need to self-soothe, or that independence is a developmental milestone, or that daycare is a neutral care arrangement, they're reading conclusions drawn from a very particular cultural setup: the nuclear family, the 40-hour work week, The home is a sealed unit where two adults and a child live behind a door.
And Hannah's instinct to question that's exactly right. The parenting ideals we treat as scientific are often the folkways of one culture wearing a lab coat. Sleep training. The emphasis on early autonomy. The idea that a baby should learn to be okay alone in a crib. None of that's derived from cross-cultural evidence. Most of it was never tested outside the weird bubble.
Let's dig into what that means for the science of parenting, and why the daycare drop-off might be a weird specific invention.
The attachment story is the clearest example. Attachment theory came out of observations in the 1950s and 60s, mostly in Western settings. Mary Ainsworth's strange situation procedure, where a mother leaves a baby with a stranger and returns, was developed in Baltimore and rural Uganda, and the pattern she found in Uganda didn't match the Baltimore patterns. Babies in Uganda protested separation just as much, but their reunion behavior looked different. They didn't need to cling to the mother the same way, because the mother wasn't the sole source of security.
So the test itself encodes a weird assumption. The premise is that there's one primary attachment figure, and the question is how the baby responds when that one person leaves. But if the baby has five attachment figures, the whole experimental design stops making sense.
Right, and what's striking is that Ainsworth saw this herself. She described the Ugandan infants as having multiple caregivers and being comfortable with being held by different people. But the field ran with the Baltimore version, because that's who was publishing and who was training the next generation of researchers.
Now apply that to daycare. The Western model assumes a baby moves from exclusive maternal care into a room with a near stranger, and we call the crying a normal adjustment period. But the crying is partly a response to a rupture that only exists because we build the rupture into the system.
Let's talk about what non-word childcare actually looks like. The norm across most of human history, and in most of the world today, is alloparenting. That's care by people who aren't the biological parents. Grandmothers, aunts, older siblings, cousins, neighbors. The anthropologist Sarah Hurdy has argued that humans are cooperative breeders in a way that's rare among primates. We're designed for distributed care.
The Kumsan of Botswana are the classic case. Infants are held by multiple caregivers from birth. A baby might pass through a dozen sets of hands in a day. Nursing is on demand, and the mother isn't the only source of comfort. Separation is gradual and never absolute, because the child has already learned that the world is full of safe people.
The Akha of Central Africa take it further. Fathers provide direct care for something like 22% of the day, which is the highest documented paternal involvement of any human society. Infants form multiple attachment bonds, and the absence of any single caregiver doesn't produce the same distress. The child isn't losing their whole security system when one person walks away.
So when Hannah asks whether non-word societies have daycare, the answer is mostly no, but not because they have some superior philosophy. It's because the institution of daycare is a solution to a problem they don't have. If care is embedded in daily life, if the baby comes to the field or the market or the workshop, there's no drop-off moment.
Daycare as a separate institution is a product of industrialization. It emerged in the 19th century when work moved out of the home and into factories and offices. Before that, in most societies, children were simply present where adults worked. The idea that you'd hand a baby to a paid professional behind a door and go somewhere else for 8 hours is historically very recent.
And here's the nuance. Separation anxiety itself is universal. It emerges in human infants around 7 to 9 months, regardless of culture. Every baby on Earth goes through a phase where they notice their caregiver leaving in protest. That's not weird. That's biology.
What's word is the shape of the separation. In a non-word setting, the baby might be passed to a grandmother who lives in the same compound, someone they've known since birth. The mother leaves, the baby cries for a minute, then settles because the grandmother is familiar. In a weird daycare, the baby is handed to someone they met last week, in a room with a dozen other crying babies, and the mother disappears for 8 hours.
The distress isn't the baby rejecting the daycare. It's the baby responding to an abrupt, institutional, recurring separation that has no analog in our evolutionary history. The first week went fine because the novelty was enough to override the attachment system. The second week, the baby figured out the pattern. This is the new normal. Mom leaves, and the crying starts.
I want to be careful here, because it's easy to slide into saying daycare is wrong. That's not what the evidence supports. What the evidence supports is that daycare is a cultural arrangement that produces a specific kind of stress, and that stress is real, and it's not a failure of parenting. It's a mismatch between what the child's attachment system expects and what the environment provides.
The Facebook group Hannah mentioned, where every mom in the neighborhood is posting about the same crying week, is a window into that. It's not that all these babies are having the same bad week by coincidence. It's that they're all hitting the same developmental wall at the same time, because they all started daycare at roughly the same age, in the same cultural structure.
Now that we've seen how non-weird societies handle care, let's turn the lens back on Hannah's situation. What does this mean for parents stuck in the weird daycare grind?
The first thing is that the guilt Hannah describes is itself culturally shaped. In a society where alloparenting is normal, leaving the child with another caregiver doesn't trigger the same anxiety, because it's not coded as abandonment. The mother isn't the sole source of security, so her absence isn't a crisis. The anxiety she feels is partly the product of a cultural story that says a good mother is always present.
And that story is very new. The intensive mothering ideology, the idea that the mother should be the primary, almost exclusive caregiver, that's a 20th century invention. It came out of post-war Western culture, and it's been exported globally through parenting books and pediatric advice. But it has no basis in how our species actually raised children for most of its history.
So when Hannah stands in the parking lot feeling like she's failed, she's measuring herself against a standard that was invented within living memory. That doesn't make the feeling less real. It makes it less true.
Let's complicate the picture, though, because non-weird societies aren't immune to separation distress. Mothers in rural Kenya or Bangladesh who leave infants with relatives to work in fields or factories report crying, too. But the distress is modulated by the caregiver's relationship to the child. If the baby is left with a grandmother they've known since birth, the crying is shorter and less intense than if they're left with a stranger. The issue isn't separation per se, it's separation from the familiar.
Which is exactly what daycare in the West gets wrong, or at least gets hard. The baby isn't just separated from the mother. They're separated from everyone they know, and placed in an environment that's loud, unfamiliar, and full of other distressed babies. The stress compounds.
There's a concept in developmental psychology called the secure base. The child uses the caregiver as a base from which to explore. When the base is stable, the child ventures out. When the base disappears, the child collapses. In a non-weird setting, the base is distributed across multiple people. In a weird daycare, the base is removed entirely for 8 hours.
The Israeli kibbutz movement is the fascinating case here, because it was a deliberate experiment in non-familial childcare within a westernized society. Starting in the 1920s, kibbutzim put children in communal children's houses. They slept there, ate there, were cared for by trained metapellet, the plural is metaplot. The parents visited in the afternoons. The idea was to free women for work and create a new socialist child-rearing model.
And it produced decades of debate about attachment. Some researchers argued the kibbutz children were fine, well-adjusted, independent. Others argued they showed signs of insecure attachment, particularly around reunion with parents. The children of the kibbutz became a battleground for the very question Hannah is asking. Does it matter if the mother isn't the primary caregiver?
What's striking is that the kibbutz children were cared for by consistent, trained caregivers who knew them for years, not a rotating cast of minimum wage workers, and still there were debates about attachment. Which suggests the question isn't just about who cares for the child, but about the continuity and intimacy of that care.
The kibbutz experiment has mostly ended. By the 1990s, most kibbutzim had abandoned communal sleeping and moved children back into family homes. The children's houses are a historical curiosity now. But they're a useful reminder that even well-intentioned, well-resourced attempts to replace the family as the primary care unit run into the same attachment questions.
So what does this mean for Hannah and Daniel? They found a lovely daycare. The baby was happy for a week. Now he cries. The evidence suggests this is a normal developmental phase, amplified by the structure of the transition. It'll likely pass. But the distress is a signal, not a malfunction.
The parental guilt is the part we can actually address. In societies where alloparenting is the norm, a mother leaving her child with a trusted caregiver feels about as guilty as a mother leaving her child with the father. It's not coded as abandonment because the child's security doesn't depend on her constant presence. The guilt Hannah feels is the product of a cultural story that says she should be the only one.
And that story is reinforced by every parenting forum, every well-meaning relative, every pediatrician who asks about the mother's return to work, as if it's a moral event. The structure produces the guilt, and the guilt produces the lingering at the window, and the lingering produces more crying. It's a feedback loop.
There's also the illness factor. Hannah mentioned the baby has been under the weather. Daycare is a pathogen exchange. Every parent knows this. The first month of daycare is basically a rolling cold, and a sick baby is a clingy baby. The crying might be partly illness, not just separation.
But even without the illness, the second week crying is predictable. The first week was novelty. The second week is the realization that this is the pattern. The baby has learned that when mom puts on the coat and picks up the bag, she leaves. And the crying starts before she even gets to the door.
That anticipatory crying is the attachment system doing its job. It's not a sign of damage, it's a sign that the baby is securely attached and protesting the separation. A baby who didn't cry at all would be more concerning, frankly.
So the daycare drop-off cry is a window into how weird parenting is a recent, unusual experiment. It doesn't mean daycare is wrong. It means we should recognize it as a cultural choice, not a scientific necessity. And the distress is a signal of the mismatch, not a failure of love.
I keep thinking about the phrase Hannah used. She said the rest of the world's parenting has thousands of years of history and development and isn't less valid because it's not Western. That's the whole point of the weird critique. The Western model isn't the default. It's the outlier.
And the outlier is now spreading. As more of the world urbanizes and adopts nuclear family structures, the daycare drop-off cry is becoming a global phenomenon. The very distress Hannah is feeling is being exported along with the economic model that produces it.
Which raises the question we'll come back to. If daycare is a weird invention, what would a non-weird daycare even look like?
I did daycare drop-off for 3 days in the late 2000s.
You what?
Little Explorers. Strip mall outside Hartford. They hired me as a drop-off specialist. My job was to stand at the door and peel crying toddlers off their parents and redirect them to the toy corner. I wasn't good at it.
What made you bad at it?
I cried too, not at first. The first morning I thought, this is easy, the kids are fine. Second morning, a little girl named Maya wrapped her arms around her mother's leg and screamed. I tried to pick her up and she went rigid. Her mother was crying. I was crying. The director came over and said, Hilbert, you have to be the calm one. I said, I'm not calm.
That seems like a problem for a drop-off specialist.
The whole job was a problem. The parents would linger at the window, the mothers especially. They'd stand there and wave, and the kid would scream harder, and the mother would cry in her car. I could see them from the parking lot. I'd be holding a screaming toddler and watching a grown woman sob into her steering wheel.
You saw the mutual performance of it.
That's the word. Performance. The baby cries because the parent is anxious. The parent is anxious because the baby cries. And the longer the parent hovers, the worse it gets. The kids who stopped crying fastest were the ones whose parents left without looking back. Walked out, got in the car, drove away. The kid would cry for maybe 90 seconds and then go find a truck.
The lingering is the problem.
The lingering is the ritual. It's the part where everyone has to prove how much they love each other by being miserable. In the 3 days I was there, I never once saw a kid cry longer than a few minutes after the parent actually left. The crying was for the audience.
That's a strong claim.
It's an observation. I'm not saying the kid wasn't upset. I'm saying the upset was being fed by the goodbye. The goodbye was the event. The separation was just the aftermath.
In a non-weird setting, there's no performance, because the caregiver is already part of the child's world. The grandmother doesn't need a dramatic handoff. She just picks the kid up, and the mother leaves.
Right. The drop-off is a word ritual. It's the moment where the culture acts out its anxiety about separation. The baby learns the script, the parent learns the script, and they perform it together every morning.
That's uncomfortably close to blaming the parent.
I'm not blaming anyone. I'm saying the ritual is the issue. The parents I saw weren't bad parents. They were doing what the culture told them to do, which is to make the goodbye meaningful. But the goodbye was making it worse. The kids whose parents treated it like dropping off a library book did better.
You quit after 3 days.
I couldn't handle the crying. Not the kids, the mothers, watching them cry in their cars every morning. I went back to the temp agency and told them to send me somewhere without children. They sent me to a warehouse that made industrial shelving.
How was that?
Don't quite get it.
The thing I keep thinking about is that Hannah's baby had a happy first week. That wasn't an accident. The novelty carried him. Then the pattern set in, and the crying started. Hilbert's right that the goodbye is a performance, but it's a performance the baby learns to dread.
The sickness probably compounded it. A baby who feels unwell is going to be more clingy, more sensitive to separation. The second week crying might have been partly the cold, partly the realization that this is recurring, and partly the goodbye ritual itself.
What would a non-word daycare look like? If we took the alloparenting model seriously, we'd want mixed-age groups, where older children help care for younger ones. We'd want consistent caregivers who stay for years, not a rotating cast. We'd want family involvement, where parents drop in during the day. We'd want the daycare to feel like an extension of the home, not a separate institution.
Some of that exists. The best daycares do have consistent caregivers and mixed-age rooms, but the economic model fights against it. Childcare workers are paid terribly, so turnover is high. Ratios are set by regulation, not by what children need. The whole system is built around cost, not around attachment.
The parents are stuck in the middle. They know the system isn't ideal. They feel the guilt, but they also need to work. The nuclear family with two working parents is the economic reality, and daycare is the patch on that reality.
Which is why the word critique is so important. It doesn't just say Western parenting is culturally specific. It says the entire structure, the nuclear family, the separation of home and work, the institutionalization of childcare, is a recent experiment. And we're running the experiment on our children without a control group.
The non-word world is the control group. And what it shows is that babies are designed for distributed care, for multiple caregivers, for gradual transitions. The daycare drop-off cry is the sound of a baby being asked to make an abrupt transition that no human baby was ever designed for.
But here's the hopeful part. The crying does stop. Most children adjust. The attachment system is flexible. It learns that the daycare is safe, that the caregivers are kind, that mom comes back. The first month is the hardest, and then it gets easier.
The guilt can get easier, too, if we understand it as a cultural artifact rather than a personal failure. Hannah isn't doing anything wrong. She's participating in a system that produces this particular kind of pain. The pain is real, but it's not a verdict on her parenting.
The open question is whether we can redesign the system. The kibbutz tried and mostly failed. But the kibbutz was trying to replace the family. A non-word daycare wouldn't replace the family. It'd extend it. It'd make the caregivers into alloparents, not substitutes.
That's the thing worth sitting with. Daniel's baby will likely adjust. The crying will fade. But the distress Hannah felt this week is a clue about the kind of childcare our species evolved for, and the gap between that and our current reality.
The gap isn't going to close on its own. But naming it, understanding it, that's the first step. Hannah's instinct to question the Western model was right. The science she thought she was following doesn't exist. What exists is a cultural arrangement, and the distress it produces is a signal, not a failure.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtuff for producing, and for the 3 days of drop-off service none of us will forget.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast.
Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Time's stay curious, keep weird in mind.